From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
The earliest references to humans cultivating trees date back to maybe 6,000 BC, and there are records of tree care tactics in the Bible, too, and from ancient Egypt. These person-to-tree interventions were the start of the science and art of arboriculture, and our best practices of pruning and other how-to have evolved in each successive era to the methods that we know today. We're going to take a look backward in history and also explore some current recommendations with today's guest, Melissa Finley, the curator of woody plants at New York Botanical Garden. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Melissa Finley is New York Botanical Garden's Thane Curator of Woody Plants and also curator of NYBG's Peggy Rockefeller Rose Garden. Woody plants are her passion. She's a certified arborist and was a forester with the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation before joining NYBG 4 years ago. And I'm so glad to welcome her to the program today. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
In this craziest of winter so far, huh? Up and down.
So unpredictable. I can't believe how hard it was raining about 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And 55 degrees.
Yeah. Madness. So speaking of tree care, just a little background, like roughly how many zillion trees and shrubs are there at that botanical garden that you and your crew
goodness.
Have to look after?
What a complex question. I think we have about 5,000 mapped trees and shrubs,
wow.
But many more that are unmapped and kind of unverified hanging out in our woodlands and natural areas. So it's hard to guess.
You better stay on your toes, you guys.
That's right.
I think of, you know, having a small number of trees and shrubs as a big responsibility, but that's epic.
We stay busy, definitely.
Yeah. So I thought we could start with kind of just a few highlights of the history of sort of mankind's attempts to manage trees. You know, I know we could do like 10 whole episodes of the show on different theories and styles that we've evolved through the ages, but I wanted to sort of hear some that really stand out to you because, I mean, I think trees have been on the earth close to like 400 million years or something. We Homo sapiens are more like, I don't know, what, a few hundred thousand years or something. So they've been around a lot longer than we have. But we've been cultivating them for like 6,000 years or something. So any highlights for you?
Yeah. So I became interested in this kind of early history of our relationship to trees when I read some articles just about kind of the history of American arboriculture and kind of how we came to do our contemporary practices of tree pruning, and found that, you know, the basic articles that were available really stopped short in the late 19th century. So I really wanted to do a deep dive on kind of how people thought about trees and approached their relationship to trees much further back. So as you mentioned, yeah, our earliest kind of cultivation practices that we have records of are about 6,000 BC in Asia Minor. But those records really do extend, you know, this is early olive tree cultivation moving from Asia Minor into Italy by the 6th century BC, which is just remarkable, unfathomable, really, amount of time.
Yeah.
And the other things I was looking for were just early kind of mentions of intentional pruning. There are several kind of references to pruning of fig trees in the Bible. They called dressing of sycamores, which refers to Ficus sycamoris, which is the sycamore fig tree. And then the other very early mentions that we find in the historical records, which I think were just fabulous, were actually from ancient Egypt. We have these wonderful paintings and records of actually the transplanting of large trees by the ancient Egyptians. There's records from the 15th century, which was during the reign of Hatshepsut, who was a female, very famous female pharaoh. And she had sent people on an expedition to what we think is probably modern-day Somalia to bring back frankincense and myrrh trees for use in rituals. They extract those resins for mummy embalming. And there's all these records of them very successfully transplanting these trees, which to us seems so modern.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Wow. So I didn't even know there was a female pharaoh, let alone that she was into transplanting, having some trees
Yes,
transplanted.
she's very interesting.
Oh, fascinating. So a long history, and it's gone through a lot of evil, it's evolved. The practices have evolved. And I mean, I imagine the tools have evolved, obviously. There were no chainsaws and all kinds of things we have today,
Right,
big
right.
buckets that went up into the treetops and so forth. But so you gave me, when we first spoke about this, just on the phone a couple of weeks back or whatever, you gave me some really interesting research papers to read. And it seemed like one of the subjects that had the most kind of differences was the pruning of mature trees as opposed to the training of young trees when they're first getting started. It seemed like with the older trees, there was a lot more, not dis well, disparity, almost, differences of tactical approaches. Is that the case?
Yes, definitely. I think, as we've been able to codify our scientific approaches to pruning, that the way that we treat mature trees has a lot more, trying to think of the best way to put it, a lot more kind of disagreement, I'll say, in the field about
Yes.
how to approach these things. I mean, trees, are very hard to study, and particularly mature trees. It's hard to do a PhD on the way that pruning affects a mature tree when you really do want to come back not 1 year later or 2 years later, but 20 years later. How do we kind of do that sort of scientific study in that long of term is very difficult. So a lot of it is short-term observation and kind of applying that as best we can to long-term understanding, which makes it all very difficult, yes.
And I mean, I know a lot of arborists just from the work I've done over the years, and then also arborists that where I live who have used employed to help me with things that are too big for me to do with trees, with older trees. And there's a lot of difference of opinion if, as a consumer, as a garden owner, who needs help. And there's words that get thrown out, phrases that get thrown out. That like what's structural pruning, and then I've least recently have heard about retrenchment pruning, and lots of seems disagreement about that, and it's hard
Yes.
for the consumer to know what's the right way.
It is. And unfortunately, it's difficult for the expert to know the right way as well. what I'll say is, luckily for the home pruner, trees that you can reach are tend to be younger trees. And those recommendations have not changed very much in the last few years. That's what we would call structural or formative pruning, is
Okay.
when we're approaching a juvenile tree, we're trying to establish a structure that will be long lasting, that will allow for proper spacing between branches and reduce the instances of the formation of bark inclusions and other things that might become what we would consider hazardous, in the future. So that's kind of what we mean when we're talking about structural pruning.
So, like in the old days, we used to talk, say, the 3 Ds, dead, damaged, and diseased, or some people had other ones, but, or things like crossed branches or inward-facing branches, or as you say, things that were a potential danger. Those are all structural things.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so a lot of that comes out of the research from Ed Gilman, who's a fantastic researcher down at the University of Florida. And he did a lot of research on young tree structural pruning, and that's where a lot of those phrases come from. I think he might have even coined the 3Ds. That's all kind of bog standard since I don't know how long ago, but his research has really proved that it seems to be good practice. So yeah, you want to start with your 3Ds, eliminate crossers, and then take a big step back, put your saw down, and look at what you have left after you've eliminated those, and really just thinking about spacing and the overall shape of the canopy. So all of that is pretty much still recommended. But when we get into the mature trees, that's when it gets really much more complex.
Yes, and so I've followed the work of some practitioners who really honor the tree through its whole life cycle, including through its decline into its death and its role in the ecosystem as, you know, this biomass that was birthed there and will live there and will die there, and you know, wanting unless there's grave danger to people or structures, to let it do its thing, so to speak. And then I've also, again, met people who do want to do adjustments to the canopy, even of older trees, or yeah. So and I never know what's the right idea.
Yeah, I mean, so what I'll say is, I think the more recent research we have, more and more is pointing to this incredible resilience that we have in trees throughout their whole lives. So in the trying to remember when this research was, there was some research done about tree life stages, where they were describing each phase of a tree's life, as you say, kind of as they go from young to mature to over mature and ancient and start to kind of crumble, that described these as inherent sort of developmental stages. And what the kind of newer research is showing is that it's really best to think about several of those phases as response phases and not so much always going to happen at such and such age, at such and such period of a tree's life. So as it's starting to decline or change its canopy shape, these are signs that the tree is responding to the world around it, to the conditions it's experiencing, and is actually actively reiterating its canopy in new ways in response to that environment. So the trees are really, really resilient. They're very perceptive of the world around them, and they're growing new wood, new structures in response to changing weather and to changing branch shapes and all kinds of things. And the field is trying to really understand how trees are shaping themselves. And so over pruning is, I think, a kind of I get it. You know, I feel that need to kind of prune these large trees in order to feel safer. But I think I'm kind of tend towards the side of trusting them to reiterate themselves and adapt to their environment over time as best we can.
And then down to the level of like the individual cuts over the years, I've heard, you know, different. I've seen, you know, obviously there's some very famous diagrams. I think some of them come from Alex Shigo or someone along the way that taught a lot of this, you know. And we hear about things like the, well, I was taught it was called the branch bark collar, but maybe it's just the bark collar, and flush cuts and how those cause greater wounds. And what about when we get to that sort of, okay, I am going to make a cut for a particular reason. And there are some tree species that have very distinctive difference in the look of their tissue where the branch meets the trunk, and some that don't. It's a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, it was very common practice to recommend flush cutting for a very long time. The oldest mention of it that I could find was from a book published in 1861 by a man called De Corval. I'm not going to try to pronounce the French. I'll totally butcher it.
I'm terrible at French, so forget it. I don't mind.
The English translation, which was later published in 1864, was titled A Treatise on Pruning Forests and Ornamental Trees. And he was advocating for flesh cutting, which, is cutting beyond that branch bark ridge directly kind of into the trunk tissue, so that you get as flat a cut as possible. And his argument is that cutting that close and even with the trunk will allow for more sap access to that wound, since the sap is flowing upward in the xylem of the tree, the vascular tissues of the tree, that having it cut flush against that trunk will expose all of the wound edges to actively flowing sap and would therefore close faster. Which makes sense. And they have actually done studies that flesh cuts do close they those wound edges do start to seal over faster. But because they are a larger wound surface, over the course of about 10 years, they've done these A/B testing and shown that eventually the branch bark ridge intact cuts do seal completely over much faster. But I was very interested in finding out why they were recommending that. And it really does make sense. It's accessing that sap, that active wood, might cause a faster regrowth.
But now, do most arborists go toward the outside the collar, outside the ridge?
Correct. Yeah. So that all comes from Alex Shigo's research. Which was just fundamental in restructuring our understanding of trees. We kind of had to wait until we could look at trees with a little finer microscope, and it kind of had to wait until we had chainsaws, basically. It allowed him to really finely cut trees and look at different cross sections. With a lot finer view, much more refinement to those cuts with a chainsaw. It's an unbelievable scientific tool, if you can believe it. So he started advocating in his 1977 report, Compartmentalization of Decay in Trees, this practice called natural target pruning. So it's replacing this flush cut right against that stem of the tree with instead cutting just outside what you refer to as the branch bark ridge. So it leaves just a little bit of a nub on the outside there. And the argument is that it both reduces the size of the cut, that cross section of wounded wood, and it retains this very specialized wood, which research has shown has this ability, the specialized ability to help seal over to occlude that wound much better than the stem tissue does.
So that's the
So
compartmentalization, is that this that place is a special
precisely.
place, and it, yeah.
Yeah, so this that tissue is much better at directing the chemistry of the tree to deposit microbe fighting chemicals and to physically seal off parts of the wood by depositing gums and just physically shutting off that area from air. All of these invading fungus especially really needs air to live. So if you seal off with gums and all sorts of cool waxes, it's able to really functionally make a new wall. And that particular area of wood is much more physically and chemically able to do those functions.
So speaking of like sort of 20th century developments, did we do things like cabling and so forth before then, or is that a modern day thing? Or I mean, because
If
there are now sort of support methods too that I see more commonly applied.
Right. Well, so the steel cabling, which is a very common practice, that was invented by John Davy, who was an English arborist who moved to the US, in the 1870s. And he wrote a book called The Tree Doctor in 1901, which introduced some of these steel cabling and steel brace rod techniques. But it's actually a much older approach. We have some evidence of the Greeks and Romans doing techniques like grafting and cabling and just kind of tying together orchard and olive and vineyard plants, and monks also mentioning it throughout the medieval period. But it was much more standardized in the early 20th century by people like John Davy and Francis Bartlett, probably the two most famous arborists from America.
Whose names then became the names synonymous with large tree companies, Davy
Exactly.
Tree and Bartlett.
That's right.
Oh, I didn't know that it had an old, history before that. That's interesting. So, we have maybe like four or five minutes, and I wanted to ask you, back at the botanical garden, are there tree species that sort of take the most resources in terms of your team, your arborist team, your tree care team there? Are there certain like high need type genera of trees versus low need? Do you know what I mean?
Sure. I mean, it's an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, I think just looking at the trees themselves, I would say the number one thing that we are always responding to is white pines dropping their branches. It's a wonderful adaptation, they are adapted to kind of alpine conditions, frequent snow and ice loading and high winds, and rather than sustaining much greater damage, they just are adapted to kind of allow their branches to break off kind of brittle and very easily to protect themselves. But yeah, they do make a big mess around here quite frequently. And then the broader question really is more about placement. So I've manufactured a rather complex system of inspections for safety for our trees, and that's primarily informed by the location of the tree and how many people are often around it, rather than the tree itself. So, if it's over a bench or a outdoor amphitheater or something like that, those are trees that I'm looking at much
Top
more frequently.
priority.
Yeah, and
Because,
pruning much more conservatively.
because for me, I would have guessed, and again, I'm a gardener. It's not as extensive a collection by any means. But certain types of trees, like I have some very, very old apple trees, and I have a number of old magnolias, seem to get where they have had wounds, so to speak, on their branches. They tend to get a lot of like water sprouty kind of bad hair day looking
Yes, they do.
growth. And that to me is a lot of work, and especially once they're big, you have to get up in them, and it's a lot of work. So certain trees seem to have that reaction more than others. I don't see that
They do,
vertical
yeah.
shoots. I don't see that as much in other species. And again, I only know those two because I have them here. I'm sure there are others that that do
Oh, and
that.
those would be the ones that I would have mentioned too. Yeah,
Oh,
absolutely.
okay.
Crab apples and cherries, the rosaceous orchard plants are very prone
Okay.
to water sprouts and root sprouts, as well as magnolias, depending on
Yeah.
the hybrid parents as well. I've found that a lot of the yellow flowered
Yes.
magnolias are prone to it, and that's from that parentage from the Magnolia cuminata, the cucumber tree.
And do you are your crews out like doing certain pruning tasks now, or do you wait until late winter? Is this a year-round thing, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, in the best of all worlds, we would be waiting until late winter to do pruning, but we have, as I'm sure you can guess, a lot of pruning to do. So we do prune throughout most of the dormant season. And of course, do emergency pruning throughout the year. But yes, now is a good time if you have a long list of things to prune. But if you can wait until the end of the season, early spring or late winter is a better time, since you're not leaving a sort of gaping wound that the tree isn't able to start responding to. I think it gives it a better chance. But yeah, we do. We will start getting into our water sprout pruning on our crab apples and cherries, as we get into the season, for sure.
Oh, That can go on forever, definitely.
It's
Even
a
here,
constant battle.
I always think to myself, I wish I had a use for all those very straight young twigs, you know, and I keep thinking, oh, I should make what we used to call pea brush, where, you know, you'd poke them in the ground and brush up your pea, you know, when you grew peas, as opposed to putting them on a trellis. That was very English, you know, very British, you know, old fashioned thing. But I've never done that with them, but boy, oh boy. It's a lot of twigs.
There's got
It's
to
a
be
lot
a
of
great
twigs.
craft for
I
it.
know. Well, if it were willows, right? We could make some
Yeah,
baskets, couldn't we,
there you
Melissa?
go.
Well, I'm so interested to, you know, I never really thought of the history part, and I was glad that you sort of turned me on to it and got me reading some references about it. And I'm glad to talk to you again. So happy year end and new year to come, and thanks for t making time today.
Of course. Happy New Year, and thanks so much for having me.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, HighMowingSeeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.